late. Maybe it's good afternoon. I don't know. It's funny, man, actually. Like I always say, you probably would never even guess that this would be like a cryptid sort of whatever with the music that begins so funkily groovy. I'm just kidding. Yeah, for real. But yeah, that's just how we wake up in the mornings. I gotta say, what do you do? What do you do? It's always like that. Always, always, always. Oh, yeah.
Now you see that evil will always triumph because good is dumb.
Yeah, I had to. How's everybody doing? So, please, call in if you, I don't know, if you have any awesome stories to add to the ones that I've got going. Today, I've got 19 of the strangest unsolved mysteries of all time. Now, that could be relative, honestly, to anything. It's always awesome when you guys call in to tell stories. I love, actually, live stories, but until I hear from anybody, I've got some pretty cool stories that, man, I gotta say, not cryptids, then they're just creepy or unsolved, weird stories. So, welcome to... yes, welcome to Stories of Cryptids and or Other Mysteries of the Universe. That is right.
That is how it goes.
You gotta be friendly if you can't be friends.
I'm telling you.
All right, man. Our first story, the incident at Dyatlov Pass. On the first night of February 1959, 9 ski hikers died mysteriously on the mountains of what is now Russia. The night of the incident, the group had set up camp on a slope, enjoyed dinner, and prepared for sleep. But something went catastrophically wrong because the group never returned. On February 26, searchers found the hikers' abandoned tent, which had been ripped open. Now, theories floated I think I've read about this one before. Surrounding the area of the footprints left by the group, some wearing socks, some wearing single shoes, some barefoot, all of which continued to the edge of the nearby woods. That's where the first two bodies were found. Yes, I've read about this one, actually. The scene bore marks of death of hypothermia, but as medical examiners inventoried the bodies, as well as others, 7 were discovered over the month that followed. Hypothermia no longer made sense. In fact, the evidence made no sense at all. One body had evidence of a blunt force trauma consistent. Say it right, Joel. Say it right. Or don't say it at all. Fact. Only one body had evidence of blunt force trauma consistent with the brutal assault. Another had third-degree burns. One had vomiting blood. One was missing a tongue. And one of their clothing was found to be radioactive. Now, if you guys ever heard of, this is a pretty big deal. The story's about... The stories The stories that you get from like the aliens and stuff, have you guys hang on, I'm looking at some. Okay, of, like, alien, you hear about alien, Well, I'm not gonna say aliens. You know how you hear about cattle, sheep, other farm animals that get. I don't know. Nobody really knows if they're getting. But somehow they're getting what would you call it? They're getting. It might as well be like surgically removed entrails and stuff like that. Now I know a lot of tongues. Are being cut out of these animals. Personally, I know. I'm just kidding. I don't personally know, but these are stories that I hear. I mean, it's like these animals are being surgically worked on, and it isn't like it's not like I don't know. I know about five doctors that go out and do this on, you know, just out in the fields on their own. I'm kidding. I don't really. But I think even this is like even happened with in the snow. With no like blood, no nothing. So I mean, I gotta say maybe these people on the mountaintop. Sounds to me like it's a encounter of some sort, but I don't know. While the seemingly born cause of the brain injuries is still a mystery, the fallout is clear. The Americans removed 60% of their diplomats from Cuba and expelled 15 Cuban diplomats. My God, all right. That's that story. Now, sickening noises. In December of 2016, a CIA officer checked into the American Embassy's health office in Havana, suffering from nausea, headache, and dizziness. Days later, two more CIA officers reported similar ailments. By late 2018, the number grew to 26 Americans and 36 Canadians experiencing nausea, hearing loss, vertigo, nosebleeds, and focusing issues. In all the cases, victims claimed that the symptoms were triggered by a strange noise they'd heard at their homes or hotel rooms. One person said the noise was high-pitched. Another described a beam of sound pointed into their rooms. Some insisted that the noise more closely resembled marbles rolling onto the along the floor. The illnesses confounded medical experts. Doctors at the University of Pennsylvania who examined some of these victims diagnosed the concussion like symptoms, but found no signs they'd suffered concussion. We know that what you must be thinking, the Cuban government is up to something, right? No, these aren't Cuban. This was another, I've read about this one too. And it's certain noises that are transponding to people. It's really weird. I've heard this a couple times. Hang on. Let me see. I think I've read about that one too. You guys ever heard of the first computer? Check this out. Then in the 1950s, a Yale University professor by the name of Derek J. De Sola Price took an interest in the mechanism. He spent years studying the artifact, which was found to contain not just one gear, but dozens of gears and other mechanisms. In a paper he wrote for Scientific America, Price concluded that the mechanism was an ancient version of a modern analog computer, which could predict the positions of planets and stars years in advance. Price's research was limited by the technology of his time, but modern-day scientists have used X-rays, CT scans, and 3D mapping technology to learn even more about the Antikythera mechanism. What they've discovered is amazing. This ancient device could perform complicated mathematical calculations in seconds. A user would input basic variables like a date, then simply turn a knob or handle on the side of the device and the mechanism could display all kinds of astronomical information about that particular date. Researchers have also recently discovered tiny encryptions written in ancient Greek, which provide even more information about the device. The machine could calculate the position of the sun and moon in relation to the 12 constellations of the zodiac, predict eclipses, contained a solar and lunar calendar, and possessed a dial that counted down the days to ancient sporting events. Huh. Heed the warning. The biggest mystery surrounding the Antikythera mechanism is how the ancient Greeks were capable of constructing such a complicated device. While it is thought to date somewhere between 205 and 60 BC, similar calculating technology was not seen again until the 17th century. Ever wonder, like, during this, it is astounding that whoever constructed the mechanism not only had modern day knowledge of astronomy but also mathematics and mechanics. I'm sorry, exactly who built the machine and why are also unknown. Perhaps it was used for research or a teaching tool. Some theorize that the sunken ship was traveling to a triumphal parade for Julius Caesar. Was the mechanism created to impress the dictator? We never know. Not funny, Lincoln. Don't do that. Really, I mean, come on. Hey, thank you. Thank you. Hey, that's not funny. Stop, stop, stop. I see you back. Hey, you made it. Now, regardless of its origin or its purpose, the mechanism remains the earliest example of an analog computer ever discovered. Price seemed to believe that it could also serve as a warning to those of us in the modern age to never take our knowledge for granted. It is a bit frightening, he once wrote. Know that just before the fall of the great civilization of the ancient Greeks had come to a close, our own age, not only in their thought, but also in their scientific technology. Well, I've seen this thing before. It's like, have you guys heard of that? Have you heard of that hammer that they found cased in rock that they carbon dated something around that was the wood of it was carbon dated like millions of years ago? How could that, oh wow, she did. How in the world could that bank possibly, I mean that bank, I was just looking at them. How in the world could a hammer of modern age? Now they're saying, have you guys heard about this, like that wood and stuff like that is, or not wood, I'm sorry, time is actually a linear thing. Hey 4Q, what's up? XACTX, how you doing? Yeah, I mean, if anybody's got any stories, do please tell, because I love. But have you heard of these? There was a hammer that was found encased in rock that was millions of years old. So some people are starting to think that time is like a linear, instead of a, not linear, I'm sorry, it's more of a stackable, but what would you, dimension, instead of like a linear dimension, which totally makes sense, but I don't know, you get all these different weird, right, it's like these cryptids that you hear about. I mean, it's almost kind of like we're making these things up in our heads and they're coming to life. And you know what, that CERN thing, you know, that they say, I mean, they're basically making portals, colliding all these particle, you know, colliders, smashing those together. They're basically making like other universes. I mean, who's to say that we're not a universe that was made of particle collider? I don't really think that that's actually true. I mean, but hey, you never know. Honestly, you don't. You didn't really. Who's to say? I can't say that there's. I believe really in everything. But you know, that's just me. Here's a story about a strange carving. While the identity of the honored cat may be a mystery, it is a different monument on the grounds, tucked away in a stone arch that has been a source of endless curiosity for hundreds of years. Known as the Shepherd's Monument, it was commissioned by the Anson family sometime between 1748 and 1763, and created by Flemish sculptor Peter Schemakers. The main part of the sculpture consists of a mirrored relief copy of Nicholas Poussin's painting, E.T. in Arcadia Ego, or The Shepherds of Arcadia, which depicts a woman and three shepherds gathered around a tomb. Above the sculpture and over the stone arch, Schemakers added stone heads, one a smiling bald-headed man, and the other, the goat-like head of the Greek god Pan. Ooh. I've heard crazy stories about this Greek god Pan. And maybe it was in a movie. That movie is pretty rad. But below the relief carvings is the strangest yet simplest part of the monument. 10 letters that seem to have no rhyme or reason. The letters O-U-O-S-V-A-V-V are carved into the stone, flanked by a D and an M. The meaning of these letters and why they were added to the monument has remained a mystery. It's not even known if Schemakers added these letters himself or if it was another craftsman carved the strange cryptid into the stone. I don't know. That's like, you know, looking for a search of the Holy Grail. Regardless of who created them or why, these 10 letters have completely confounded historians, investigators, and codebreakers, but theories abound. Many have interpreted the D and M to refer to the Latin phrase Dis Manibus, an inscription often found on Roman tombs that means dedicated to the shades. Of course, the Shepherd's Monument is not a Roman tomb, so not everyone buys into the theory. But the idea that each letter in the carving could correspond to the first letter of a word in a phrase is a strongly held hypothesis amongst investigators. One theory states that O-U-O-S-B-A-V-V refers to Orator ut omnia sunt venitas vantanum, a Latin interpretation of Excelsis 12:8, vanity of vanities, saith the preacher, all is vanity. I mean, but I don't know. Biblical theory posits that John 14:6, I am the way, the truth, and the life, is reflected in the letters, which may stand for Oro ut Oms Sequitur Viam Ad Viam, a prayer that all follow the way of to true life. Okay. I don't know where that story really goes. But some investigators believe the random letters are a code that refers to a name of navigational direction, or perhaps, most fanciful of all, the location of the Holy Grail. And people have been looking. I'm curious to see if ever is a, if, you know, anyway, the Holy Grail type thing. I mean, I don't know. I'm not saying it wouldn't be real, but God, man, it'd be about like finding another civilization. But I don't know. And that's about all it says. Not sure. But here's a little story. Brave New World. These days, visitors to Kecksburg will be hard-pressed to find any trace of the encounter. Perhaps, no. Some of these stories, I get some of these from people and I don't really say that it's anything that would make sense to me. Have you guys heard how John Lennon sees a UFO? This is a pretty, well, Lucy in the Sky with Warp Drive. In May 1974, former Beatle John Lennon and his assistant, Mistress May Pang, returned to New York City after almost a year's stay in Los Angeles, a period to which Lennon would later refer as his lost weekend. The pair moved into the penthouse tower B at 434 East 52nd Street. As Lennon watched television on a hot summer night, he noticed flashing lights reflected in the glass of an open door that led into a patio. At first, dismissing it as a neon sign, Lennon suddenly realized that since the apartment was on the roof, the glass couldn't be reflecting light from the street. So sans clothing, he ventured onto the terrace to investigate. What he witnessed has never been satisfactorily explained. Speechless, a Pangra recollected, Lennon excitedly called for her to come outside. Pang did so. I looked up and stopped mid-sentence and said later, I couldn't even speak because I saw the thing, this thing was up there. It was silvery, and it was flying very, very slowly. There was a white light shining around the rim and a red light on the top. It was silent with no sound. Pretty sure that's what silent means. But we started to watch it drift down, tilt slowly, and it was flying below rooftop. And it was most amazing sight. She quickly ran back into the apartment, grabbed her camera, and returned to the patio, clicking away. Lennon friend and rock photography legend Bob Gruen picked up the story. In those days, you didn't have answering machines, but a service staffed by people. And I had received a call from Dr. Winston. Lennon's original middle name was Winston, and he often used the alias Dr. Winston O'Boogie. When Gruen returned the call, Lennon explained his incredible sighting and insisted that the photographer come around to pick up and develop the film personally. He was serious, Gruen said. He wouldn't call me in the middle of the night to joke around. Gruen noted that although Lennon had been known to partake in mind-altering substances in the past, which I was going to say something about, during this period, he was totally straight. Really? Well. So Pang, a non-drinker who never took drugs and whom Gruen characterized as a clear-headed young woman, the film in Pang's camera was a unique type supplied by Gruen, four times as fast as the highest speed then commercially available. Gruen had been using this specialty film, usually employed by military reconnaissance, of course. I don't know, that's kind of funny, but anyway, the same role already had photos of Lennon and former bandmate Ringo Starr taken by Pang in Las Vegas during a recording session. Gruen asked Lennon if he'd reported his sighting to the authorities. Yeah, like I'm going to call the police and say I'm John Lennon and I've seen a flying saucer, the musician scoffed. Bruin picked up the couple's phone and contacted the police, the Daily News, and New York Times. The photographer claims that the cops and the news admitted that they'd heard similar reports, while the Times just hung up on him. It would have been an ultimate tip. Bruin's most amusing recollection of Lennon, who had been hollering UFO and Take Me With You, was that none of his New York City neighbors either saw or heard the naked ex-Beatle screaming from the penthouse terrace. Disappointingly, no one who might have piloted the craft responded to Lennon's plea. That's what I would say. I'd be like, take me with you. I wish Sarah was joining us. She's always here to say what's up, but she is, she's at work, but she'll be joining us. I think, that'll be Saturday she'll be here. So that'll be fun. Anyway, I've got to take a short break. You guys, I'm going to leave you with something so you're not bored. I will be right back. Don't go anywhere. I've got these really cool stories about some cryptids. These are actually very, very new. So I'm going to take a short break. I'll be right back. And so don't go anywhere.
evil will always triumph, because good is dumb.
All right, now, let me sift over one short story over one. this one, where did it? Let me sift. Actually, no, let me go back to this. Let me, yeah. That's what I always say. I always say we should be down instead of up. However, let me shift over to this. This is a story that comes out of Oregon. It's kind of long, but bear with me on it. Stay with me on it. It is the thing in the field. Okay. Out of Oregon's pretty crazy. When I was young, I lived on a farm in rural Oregon with my parents. I was the only child. We weren't a big commercial farm, just a family type thing. We had 5 cows, 3 horses, a small herd of goats, 2 dogs, and 1 chicken coop. We also had some Indian runner ducks. We kept mostly as pets, though. We didn't really make any money off the place, just enough to sustain the animals and a little extra for ourselves. Money enough to take out a decent vacation every couple of years, but Dad had his other job in town, an insurance agent. He was the only one around, really, but the town wasn't more than about 1,500 people. Mom gave horse riding lessons as well. We weren't rich, but we were comfortable. It was really an easy life, or at least it could have been a lot worse. I went to school, Dad went to work, Mom took care of the animals. Then we all had dinner together every night, and I would go to bed while Mom and Dad had a beer or two and watched the news. Sometimes at night, I would hear things outside, mostly just normal stuff. The cows or horses would get spooked by a coyote or something. Or I would hear the dogs chasing a rabbit, barking their heads off, never shutting up. Every once in a great while, we would find a dead chicken. Dad would always tell me about it, but nevertheless he would never let me see the body. Although I asked frequently, he still would never let me see it. He would keep Mom and I inside until he had gone out, did whatever he did with the body, throw sawdust over any blood, and then life would go on as normal. I assumed it was foxes, as I had seen a couple of them in the pasture over the years, sinking around back and forth through the grass. The summer when I was 10 years old, I remember helping Mom change the bedding on the horses' stalls when we heard a huge racket going on outside. If you've never heard the sound of a horse in pain, you don't want to, trust me. It sounds almost like a person screaming. Well, that's what we heard. And one of our horses, the Palomino, came running into the barn with a wound on its left thigh. Four long marks, like claw marks, ran across its body for about a foot. It had blood running down its leg, and it was. Eventually, Mom came inside and told me that the horse had hurt itself on the barbed wire that ran the perimeter of the pasture. We owned more land before that, or beyond that, but it was mostly forested. I guess I believed her at the time, but at dinner that night, I noticed Dad was being particularly quiet, and Mom was talking a lot more than normal. He was being really animated, and I noticed that Dad had gotten his rifle out and set it by the back door. Usually, he only did that when the coyotes had been acting up. That night, I went to bed as normal, but I had trouble falling asleep. I turned on my desk lamp and decided to read comic books until I got tired. I have a very vivid memory of reading Uncanny X-Men and hearing the back door open. Looking out, I could see my dad by the porch light, lighting a cigarette and holding his rifle under his arm. He started walking over to the driveway and then turned to follow the fence line. I couldn't sleep until I knew my dad was back safe. I kept coming downstairs with the excuse of getting water to see if Dad was back in the house yet. And each time all I saw was Mom sitting on the couch in the living room, staring at a blank TV screen and looking worried, sighting occasionally, but same. Eventually, about 4 a.m, I think, Dad did come back, and I was so tired and relieved that I fell asleep as soon as I knew he was home. He never told me what he did that night, but I never thought to ask. 2 months later, I was back in school. It rains a lot in Oregon in the fall, and this day was no different. All I could hear from the bedroom was rain hitting the ground and the aluminum roof of the kitchen, of the chicken coop. Talk right, Joy. There was light thunder in the distance, but it was slowly getting closer. I thought I had heard a coyote yapping around the garage, or it could have been one of the dogs. I looked out, straining my eyes to see whatever that was out may have been running around. In a brief and distant lightning flash, I saw something. It looked almost like a person, but hunched over and with a long torso. It was tall, taller than Dad, who was good 6 foot tall, 4, at least. I just barely caught a glimpse of it on the near side of the garage. Then the light faded, and I didn't see anything again that night. There was another dead chicken the next morning, the third in just as many weeks. I told Dad what I had seen the previous night. The color went out of his cheeks momentarily, until he told that the storm must have been playing tricks on my eyes. I accepted that. 4 months later, after that, we lost a cow. It was in the middle of the night, and we all woke up at the same time. There was a lot of noise in the pasture, but only briefly. The cry of a dying animal and a primitive, guttural yell that I had never heard before. Dad rushed up to my room. I could hear him running up the stairs to my room. He had his rifle in his hand, and he opened my door. He saw I was awake and told me to stay inside no matter what and try to go back to sleep. I don't think I have to say that sleep wasn't really an option any longer, but I did stay in my room with a blanket held tight around my shoulders and staring out the window. Probably about 10 minutes later, I heard gunshots in the field. I don't know what he was shooting at, whether it was whatever had attacked the cow or the cow itself trying to put the animal out of its misery. Dad rarely, if ever, talked about that night. I later found out that he had gotten to the cow only to find it ripped open on the ground, bleeding out from its torso. The shots that I heard were him shooting the cow in the head to finish it off. It kept going like that for years, a chicken or a duck there, here and there. Something bigger only very rarely. It sounds absurd, but I almost came to think of it as a common place. I only ever caught glimpses of the thing until what comes next. It terrified me. It happened in the middle of the day, over the course of a long weekend when my parents had gone to Seattle to see my uncle, who was ill. It was on a Saturday afternoon. I was 17 years old. I was out in the barn putting out food for the horses and the dogs. The horses were running around out in the pasture, and the dogs were asleep in the corner of one of the horse stalls. I heard something rustling in the tall grass outside in the pasture. The dogs looked around a little bit, but I didn't seem to mind them. I assumed it was just one of the horses waiting for me to leave so they could eat. I kept going about what I was doing, and in several minutes, I thought I heard breathing. I turned to look, and it was standing in the door, tall as hell, even hunched over. The sun was streaming in behind it, lighting up all the dust in the air around it like some kind of sickly halo. It was looking straight at me, considering me. Maybe it was trying to decide whether or not I was food. I remember swearing, turning, and running as fast as I could through the house, not even thinking. Panic causes my legs to move. It was behind me, not even breathing hard. I heard his feet hitting the ground in a constant rhythm. I got to the house, opened the door, slammed it behind me, and locked it as fast as I could. I tore through the house, locking every door and drawing the blinds on every window. I could hear it snarling outside the back door. The dogs were barking at it, but they wouldn't try to attack the thing. It was so big that they knew it. It roared at the dogs and they ran off, probably to hide in the pasture. I went to my parents' bedroom and got Dad's rifle. I loaded it, set up a chair in the living room facing the back door, and waited. I started prowling around the house. I could hear its feet crunching on the gravel of the driveway and the wooden planks on the back deck. It kept walking back and forth. I thought about trying to look through a window to see it, but I was too scared. Eventually, after hours of hoping it would go away, the sun went down. Oh God, that's when things get bad. I turned on all the outside lights and went up in my room. I open my window with the rifle in my hands, hoping to be able to pick the thing off from above. I saw it lurking just beyond the glow from the porch light. It had long, sinewy arms. Sinewy arms, and walked on bent knees. It was by the chicken coop. Then it disappeared from view. I heard the chicken squawking and screeching. The thing reappeared with a dead, bloody chicken in its hands. It bit off one of the wings with its jaws that were dripping, wow, with slime and drool, and let the dead bird drop to the ground at its feet. Then it looked at me. Its eyes made contact. Wow. Its eyes made contact with my eyes. It turned away again, back to the chickens. It came back with another bird, mutilated in front of me, and dropped it. It went back again and again. I should have taken a shot at it, but I was astounded and confused trying to figure out what it was doing. Then it hit me. It was a show of power. It was showing me that it was stronger than me, that it could do whatever it wanted to do because I couldn't stop it. At the same time, I felt powerless and sickened. Powerless because what it was saying was true. If it was just that thing and me, I wouldn't stand a chance. Sickened because I realized what kind of intelligence it would need to be able to convey the message. The thoughts shook me out of my stupor, and I remembered the rifle at my side. It was heading back to the chickens, and I decided when it came back, I would take my shot. It strode back to the porch, almost arrogant, walking on bended knees, and those arms were so long that the chicken was nearly dragging on the ground. I raised the rifle up to my eye and tried to steady myself. My heart was beating so hard I could see the rifle shaking ever so slightly in rhythm with each heartbeat. I could hear pounding in my own ears. It raised the body to its mouth, and just as it was about to put the chicken's head inside, I squeezed the trigger. Boom! The crack of the gun echoed in the now shattered quiet of the night, my nighttime standoff, and I heard it howl. A painful, loud, startled howl. I had it on the south side of my shoulder. It ran into the night. I never saw it again. It was still out there, though. It still killed chickens and other things more often than before. I'm writing all this now because my parents died 3 years ago. They were killed in a collision with a drunk driver. He survived. They left me the farm, and I intend to live here with my own family. I'm 32 now, and I work for an Oregon Fish and Game office in Salem. I'm married to a wonderful woman named Stephanie. We have one son, Zachary, who is 4 years old. We are expecting a daughter in the 4 months. I've come to the farmhouse alone today. I told Steph that I would just wanted some time alone in my parents' house to deal with some emotions. She was very understanding about it. Don't go anywhere. I've got to take a short break. A short break it was. I know, Lincoln. I'm sorry. I know. Here we go. On with the story. I've come back to claim what was rightfully mine. I have Dad's rifle next to me on the table, and it is almost dusk. I've also brought several portable halogen lights to set up around the house and my own shotgun. I'm borrowing a handgun from Joe, a guy at Fish and Game who I work with. When I am done typing this account of my memories, I will print it out and leave it on the dining room table, along with my wedding ring and my key to the safe deposit box where my will is kept. Everything is loaded and ready. Hopefully, I will return here to collect these things, and nobody will ever know I wrote this. Steph, in the event that you are the unfortunate soul to find this, which I'm terrified to think seems a likely outcome, the thought of you having to go on alone hurts me more than anything in the world that could ever be. Know that I love you more than anything, and I hope you understand that I am doing this to keep you safe. Zachary, I love you and can only hope you grow up to be a good, kind-hearted, and strong man like your grandfather was. To my unborn daughter, if I don't live long enough to meet you, it will be the single greatest regret of my life. Tell the police, tell Fish and Game, call Joe. He's one of the few people that knows about this. Make this situation known. Eventually, someone will kill it. Even if it isn't me, goodbye for now. That is it. Well, Joe, I'd like to know what... I would like to know what happened on the final on that, but pretty good story. I dig it. Well, everybody, I think that concludes episode, what are we on, 6? Well, there's a little lighthearted music for you. I don't like to, not for people to be left scared. No one likes that. I hope you guys had a good time with me today. Everybody, please hit follow if you have not done that yet. And if you had fun, leave any comments. Definitely follow. And you guys, let's build this together. You guys, I hope you have a wonderful day, and to no avail, another show prevails. I appreciate and thank all of you.